Radio EcoShock. Occasionally, a window opens to jumpstart the big transition we need to renewable energy. It can close just as quickly with more dashed hopes for the future. Last week, a giant Norwegian investment fund promised to spend billions on renewable energy. Sierra Club India saw an opportunity to finance the need for solar power in India. We'll discover what happened and what could be with our guest, Justin Guay of Sierra Club. Justin, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me.
The Norwegians have the biggest national investment fund in the world. How big is it and how did they get it?
Well, it's roughly a little bit short of $1 trillion, which is just a tremendous pool of capital. And it has largely come from their investments in oil and gas.
So that's in the North Sea where they've been out there drilling. I guess most of it comes from that.
That's right.
Okay. Now, in February, as you told me, Reuters News Agency reported the Norwegians would divest their holdings in climate-killing coal. Did they do it with this new announcement?
You know, what the Norwegians did was produce a lot of hype, and their announcement has actually produced very little substance. What we do know is that they will now have a one-year review of their exposure to carbon-producing fossil fuels, so across the board, coal, oil, and gas. And then at the end of that year, they will decide what to do.
So they haven't actually gotten out of coal at all this year.
That's right. And that's really disappointing considering, you know, what we've found from many of the institutions who have begun the divestment process is that coal is really the low-hanging fruit. It's quite easy, especially compared to oil and gas investments, to divest from coal.
Before we talk about more Norwegian results in Norway, let's get to your vision to satisfy India's solar requirements. In a nutshell, what is needed there?
Well, if you look at the state of the electricity sector in India today, there are roughly a quarter of Indians who don't have any access to power at all, which means that the electricity grid is not delivering them any form of power that would help support very basic interventions, things like lighting at night so that kids can study, fans to help them with the incredible heat that can come through India, as well as mobile phone charging, which is, you know, tremendously important for communications. And right now, the Indian government is more or less focused on expanding that grid and pumping a lot more power through the existing lines. The problem is that's failed for decades, and so, you know, 300 to 400 million people are still living in the dark. The exciting part is that a number of entrepreneurs and companies are working around this broken system, and they are deploying distributed renewable energy that is getting power in the hands of people today. And you can measure that in days and months, not years and decades, as the grid has tried to expand out to these populations. So there's a tremendous opportunity to get power, really catalytic amounts of power, in the hands of poor populations now. That power just so happens to be renewable, so it's also a huge opportunity to deploy clean energy around the world.
So, yeah, for India, you specifically recommend off-grid solar instead of the giant central plants like the Americans just built in California. Why?
It goes back to that mix I just outlined. There are 300 to 400 million people in India who don't even have access to the grid, so pumping more even clean solar power into the grid does nothing to help social inequality. And I think that's where the true power of solar lies. Solar, by its nature, is a distributed resource. So it makes a lot more sense to deploy it in small, modular, incremental deployments, which means you can actually get power directly into the hands of the populations that need it the most. And I think that's tremendously powerful for both democracy, for social development, and for helping to reduce a lot of the inequality that we see, not only in India, but around the world.
So you've looked outside of India for some other examples. You've written about solarization in sub-Saharan Africa, for example. What's happening there?
Well, I think that, you know, when you look at where the greatest amount of innovation and the greatest amount of deployment is happening, it's both India and sub-Saharan Africa. According to the World Bank's Lighting Africa program, the off-grid solar market grew at a 95% compound annual growth rate over the last few years. And that's just explosive growth. I mean, that's the kind of growth that tech companies here in the United States would drool over. And I think that's a reflection of the fact that solar is just so appropriate for these communities. The other really interesting thing is that many of these solar companies are pioneering innovations that are very similar to solar home leases that have helped unlock the economics of solar for average Americans and average Canadians. And they're doing a very similar thing called pay-as-you-go solar, which allows poor populations to pay for power as then when they need it with appropriate amounts of money that reflect their cash flows and incomes. And so what we have now essentially is the ability for these poor consumers to overcome the upfront costs and be able to afford the amount of solar that they require.
Right. There's no way they're going to come up with a couple thousand dollars even for solar panels, but they could pay it over time. What's happening with solar power in Bangladesh, right next door to India?
Well, I think that's another really, really exciting story that very few people know. Just 2 years ago, Bangladesh surpassed 1 million solar home systems in the country. They now are up to 2 million, and they are deploying anywhere from 50 to 90,000 solar home systems every single month. So really, they're a hotbed of distributed solar deployment. And, you know, they are growing much faster than the country's grid expansion and actually making a very serious dent in the electrification problems the country faces. When you look at Bangladesh, I think the real story there is that solar is delivering development, which I think is a very different narrative than many people have around whether or not renewables are appropriate for poor populations and developing countries.
And is there a part of India where solar power is hot and doing well?
Absolutely. I've written a piece about Uttar Pradesh, which is one of the poorest and least electrified states in the country. It's home to about 200 million people. So you're looking at a single Indian state that is almost as big, about two-thirds the size of the population of the United States. It's just a tremendous population that lives without any power at all. And there are a number of really exciting, innovative companies that are deploying anywhere from solar lanterns to solar home systems to even solar mini-grids. Companies like Simpa, Miragao, OMC, and they are really starting to lay the groundwork for a distributed solar revolution in that state. I think the other one to look at is Bihar, which is, again, a notoriously backward, undeveloped state in the country of India. And now what we're seeing is just a tremendous amount of activity as entrepreneurs and companies try to work around the failing solutions that many have pushed for decades. And what we're seeing is that they're working.
So take us through the actual process on the ground. Say an Indian farm family wants solar power. How do they get it?
Well, many of these companies have local sales agents who are either members of the community or have very close ties to the community. And that would be your first point of contact with the company. Those sales agents would make a house call. They would assess your power needs. They would assess your ability to pay. And then they would propose a solution. After they make that initial sales contact, then the company would send out technicians. They would install the solar home system on your roof, and then you would set up a payment scheme. And what you see is that it's very similar to what we would do here in the developed world, very professional, and it really treats these populations the same way we would want to be treated as customers, as equals, not as beneficiaries of philanthropic goals.
So we're going to talk about finance here, and I might start by asking, who is Jigar Shah and what is he up to?
So Jigar Shah is really a pioneer in the solar industry. He was the one who pioneered the solar as service business model, which helped unlock the economics of solar by overcoming the high upfront cost hurdle. He helped pioneer the power purchase agreement, which enabled companies to sign up commercial customers and then eventually residential customers for solar services. And he is now the author of a book, Creating Climate Wealth, and he is a widely respected and widely known author who has been advocating quite openly and quite aggressively for increased investments for solar, in particular, to support poor populations in India as well as sub-Saharan Africa.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex, and my guest is Justin Gui from Sierra Club India. We're talking about rich countries and developing countries like Norway and India. So, Justin, the poorest people in the world pay a large amount of the world's bills for lighting, but they hardly get any of it. How does that work?
Yeah, it's really one of the most unequal and biggest travesties today. So the poor end up, because of the lack of grid connection, paying for really, really expensive and dangerous and polluting forms of lighting, mostly kerosene-based lighting, as well as candles and even wood. And what that means is that they end up paying a tremendously high actual direct cost in the form of cash provided for these fuels, and then they get really, really poor quality and poor health in return. You compare that to what we get either through the grid or through your regular incandescent light bulb, and we pay much, much lower amounts and we get tremendously higher quality light. So moving these populations beyond kerosene and onto electrical forms of light is really an important thing for reducing the amount of money they spend on polluting fuels, increasing their health outcomes, and then, of course, providing a huge opportunity for development in the form of extended hours for kids to study and even extended work hours for those who maintain local shops.
Yes, we take all that for granted, and we shouldn't. Now, besides Norway, you also asked the World Bank to invest that important $500 million into Indian solar. How did that go?
We have worked with a number of these entrepreneurs to help create a voice that is demanding roughly $500 million in risk-adjusted funding to help unlock this market and help unlock the opportunity that these entrepreneurs see today. What we are seeing is that, you know, none of these institutions have stepped up and owned this problem, which I think is a travesty. I mean, the World Bank is the foremost development institution in the world. They have anywhere from an $8 to $12 billion annual energy portfolio, asking for a very small percentage, $500 million of that portfolio is really nothing for a job that they should already be doing. Now, that being said, they do have some small energy access programs, Lighting Africa, Lighting Asia, the Green Power for Mobile program. They're really important programs that are helping to lay the foundation for the distributed solar market. Unfortunately, they're not putting their investment dollars where their mouth is, and that's where I think we want to see a big shift.
Yeah, $500 million. I mean, North Americans spend billions on pet food. J.P. Morgan Bank paid over $10 billion in fines this year for tricky financing that they did. It really isn't a large amount of money. I can't believe that nobody in the world can come up with this.
That's absolutely right. I think the biggest problem we see is not that there's a lack of money to solve this problem. The biggest problem is that the money is going in the wrong places. And I think that, you know, for all of the talk about energy access and energy poverty and the United Nations Sustainable Energy for All initiative, the truth is we're just spending the money very, very poorly. And it's really time for these development institutions to start putting their money where their mouth is and supporting the kinds of solutions that can get power in the hands of poor populations today, not decades from now.
So getting back to Norway, I looked at their announcement, or at least what little the news has told us about their announcement about the Norwegian Investment Fund, and they're still not ready to invest in infrastructure directly. They just sort of direct their fund managers towards a small amount of purchases of more environmentally friendly stocks. Is that going to cut it?
Absolutely not. This mandate changes very little, despite the fact that the Prime Minister raised our expectations that there would be a significant announcement. I think even more importantly, they're not even living up to what their neighbors Denmark are doing, which, you know, they're investing over 5% of their fund into renewable energy infrastructure, and they plan to double that. So this is clearly the bar that Norway should be trying to meet and exceed if they want to be a leader and if they want to be serious in any way, shape, or form. So I think what we see is, quite a disappointing announcement, and I think there's going to be significant amounts of pressure for Norway to actually deliver after all of the expectations that they've set.
So how much are they promising to spend on this?
Oh, it's quite a small amount. It's roughly $5 to $8 billion when, you know, the expectations were 5% of their total portfolio, which would have been almost $50 billion.
Right. And you know, I did a little calculation. There's 5 million Norwegians, and they've got $860 billion at least in their wealth fund. That's $172,000 per man, woman, and child in that country. So if you have a family with three kids, you're a millionaire just from what you've got in that fund. I'm almost wondering whether there comes a point, aside from divesting in coal, where Norwegians will have to say, because of the world climate problem, we're going to leave that oil and gas in the ground. We can't just keep pumping it out till 2030. The climate will be insane by then. What are your thoughts on that?
Oh, that's absolutely right. I think if you follow some of the great work that Carbon Tracker has done about exposure to the carbon bubble, it's not even about, you know, the moral and social mandate, which we clearly have to divest from fossil fuels, but I think there's really an economic imperative. I think that countries like Norway that continue to keep their investments in these fossil fuel infrastructure projects really risk the long-term economic health and viability of their fund. And so I think that, you know, the wise economic decision is really to divest not even necessarily on climate grounds, but simply because the economic case is so much stronger for renewable energy, and the risks around fossil fuel expansion are just so great that it's really difficult to see the economic case going forward, especially 15 to 20 years from now.
Yeah, for low-lying countries like Bangladesh or Tuvalu or the coasts of India, Norwegian fossil fuel profits could doom millions either to death or as forced climate refugees. Countries like Norway, Saudi Arabia, the United States may have to pay reparations if they aren't broke by then already because of climate change. What do you think? Isn't it cheaper to invest in the solar now than try and clean up that mess 20 years from now?
Absolutely. I mean, we're even seeing that today here in the United States. Utilities are overbuilding capacity for power demands that they thought would materialize, and then they don't materialize. So we pay once for all of these huge natural gas and coal-fired power plants. They don't run. We realize we don't need them, so we have stranded assets. And then at the same time, we realize that it's really important for a number of reasons to diversify our energy supply towards a basket of renewables, be it solar, wind, energy efficiency, and so we pay again. And so I think that it's just ridiculous for us to not make much wiser decisions upstream so that we can really get ahead of the curve and stop wasting very scarce public resources on unneeded capacity, unneeded power that is killing the environment, killing the planet, and really dooming millions of people around the world.
Well, maybe it's not too late, as you say, for Norway to rethink its way forward into renewables. The World Wildlife Fund is also very disappointed in this announcement. What are you calling for them to do? What does Sierra Club want Norway to do with this big bunch of money?
Well, I think that we are in the very same boat as WWF. What we would like to see is a strong 5% mandate for renewable energy investment. A mandate that starts with that as the low end of the bar and moves forward and increases as time moves on. We would like to see them be able to invest directly in renewable energy infrastructure. And we'd also like to see a carve-out for distributed solar that specifically helps poor populations to alleviate energy access issues, alleviate energy poverty. You know, and that carve-out would be 1% of their total mandate for renewables, or roughly $500 million. So it's a very small, marginal amount. Norway can clearly do this. They will make money on these investments. It's not about philanthropy. So there's really no excuse. And I think there's going to be a tremendous amount of pressure from WWF, ourselves, and many others going forward to make sure that this actually happens.
So, Justin, you've been published all over, including the Huffington Post and a lot of different media outlets. How can people find you, and how can they find the Sierra Club India?
Yes, absolutely. So I write a regular blog on the Huffington Post, so please check that out. I'm on Twitter. My handle is at Guay, G-U-A-Y, underscore J-G. And then we also have a website that regularly cross-posts my blogs and provides information on our work in India and our work internationally, sierraclub.org/international. So we'd love to have people learn more about these issues and get involved.
So thank you, Justin Guay, and please keep me posted about the energy situation in India. I'm always watching that. I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock listeners.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.